Hello, my name is Jonathan Weiner, and welcome to Headroom. Today, we're going to be looking at the idea, the concept of bias in data as it relates to machine learning. Andy Saroff, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Andy, you are currently a research engineer and a developer. Is that the correct title to use in the context of working at iZotope?
Just a research engineer.
Research engineer, great. And your background, whether or not you want to admit it, my understanding is that you have been an audio engineer in a previous incarnation. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I spent about a decade doing audio mixing and recording. Then I went on to get involved in machine learning for audio, and I did a master's in the Marl group at NYU, and moved on to do my PhD in computer science at Dartmouth College.
Cool. So a two-part question.
Yes.
How did audio and technology get hooked up in the first place, or music and technology get hooked up in the first place for you? And then how does a studio engineer decide to go back to school and get involved in audio with machine learning?
Well, the first part is a little bit easier to answer. I would say that, being a recording engineer, I think most recording engineers really like to get their hands dirty and understand why or how the processing gear that they use changes the sound that they use. So I always had a strong interest in understanding, like at a deeper level, how all this gear that I was using on a daily basis to record and mix actually functioned. The second question was really just that the recording industry kind of took a nosedive in New York City in the mid-2000s, and I found myself with a mixing studio and not a lot of clients, and I decided to kind of just go back to school and figure out, a new path to take. I was very lucky to start in this program at NYU, where there are a few new hires, including Agnieszka Roginska and Juan Bello, and they took me under their wing and kind of introduced me to the science of and computer science of audio, and I thought it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I went from there directly into basically what we call music informatics. So that's the field of extracting information out of musical data. And this field was mind-blowing to me. I didn't even know that this existed. It was a lot of fun, and then I decide, okay, well, I've done a little bit of computer science, so now I'm going to make it really hard and go after a computer science PhD. I worked briefly in a computer science department in Singapore for about 6 months, again, working on music informatics, and then started my, PhD career at Dartmouth College, where I decided, well, I'm not only interested in computer science and music and audio, but I want to know what this new thing called deep learning is. So this is back in 2010. Deep learning was still very much just a buzzword back then. And I built my whole PhD dissertation around complex audio and complex neural networks. Mm-hmm. And that is just to say that when we work with audio, in computer science, a lot of times we're working with it in the frequency domain. And I assume that you know this, but in the frequency domain, we have a magnitude and a phase component. And at least in 2010, 11, and 12, no one was doing anything with phase. We would just throw that out because it's very difficult to work with. So I tried to bring complex numerical representations into deep machine learning. And now I'm pretty much here at iZotope.
That's interesting. For a moment, when you were talking about sort of extracting information from audio, maybe this isn't a good analogy, but maybe it is. So I'll throw it out there. It occurs to me that composers sort of do the same thing, in terms of making observations, pulling out information, understanding. Maybe the vocabulary is very different. It's around gesture or something like that. But a way of abstracting an idea in order to inform their work. Might be a ham-fisted analogy, but
I'd say that's absolutely true. And a lot of the early motivation for music informatics and music information retrieval was trying to find automatic ways to do things that humans could do very easily. So this kind of built out of the subfield of machine listening, the idea that a computer might not just be able to see, as in computer vision, but might actually be able to listen and make inferences that would align with the way humans make inferences.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Oh boy, that's, for some reason, that it's a little unsettling, you know, even now to think about machines making inferences, but let's go there. Okay. So, so let's dive into the topic of, the data and how it informs what machines learn and machine learning. And, you know, if we use the idea of like how a three-year-old learns things, you know, you give a three-year-old information and they will learn that information. They'll sort of take the examples that you give them, and then at some point, you know, they learn them literally, and at some point they begin to extrapolate and learn sort of abstracted layers of concepts built around that. And depending on what you teach them, well, that's what they will learn. So, you know, give us some thoughts about, just broadly speaking, how to approach this idea about making sure that the thing that you're teaching your computer, you know, is the right thing.
Yeah, it's actually a really it's a really complicated question that doesn't have a one-line answer. First, I'm going to push back on this idea that machine learning is like a three-year-old, because a three-year-old gets a lot more guidance from the real world than a machine learning algorithm. There's this kind of, I feel like there's this dissonance a little bit between the way machine learning is marketed versus the way that it actually happens in the research laboratory. And that is to say that, you know, it's rarely intelligent. I know that that we like to use the word artificial intelligence, but if you, this gets philosophical, really, about your definition of what intelligence is. But I would say that machine learning is rarely intelligent, and it is very, it's a data-driven process, and you basically develop some, you know, algorithms that can optimize some sort of loss function. We have some idea of what success is. So starting there, you know, the idea of success for the application that you have in mind can be loaded with all kinds of, you know, implicit biases or ideas of what you think success of the application is. And then you need to, you know, you create this algorithm, you build all these layers that kind of take the information that goes into your model and transforms it and hopefully extracts meaningful features, not to you, but to the model, to generate an inference, to make a decision. So at the top, you have this, the task, which is dominated by our idea of what success is. And at the bottom, you have all the data that's used to learn how to do this task well. And I'd say that, you know, designing those two parts are as important, or maybe much more important, than all the really fancy stuff that happens in between in terms of the kind of model that you build. We talk about all these convolutional models or temporal models, and, you know, they get very deep in terms of deep learning. But, you know, the data that goes into the model is the worldview of the model. So it's not like the three-year-old who kind of has the ability to explore. I know that there's some people in machine learning that will tell me that, okay, machine learning algorithms explore too. There's a subtopic of reinforcement learning, but we're kind of not going there either, because in that setting too, the environment that gets explored is very limited. It all comes down to what you provide to your model to learn from. It's basically very, very fancy pattern matching and information extraction.
Mm-hmm. So there are sort of two endpoints that you pointed to. One is the data itself, and then the sort of goal. And it hadn't occurred to me to think about the idea of, although now it seems obvious, to think about the idea of bias in the goal. Are you saying that in some way you set, you know, you're deciding sort of what you're hoping to learn from the outset, and of course there would be bias that's written into, or potentially bias that's written into that goal, depending on how it's set up?
Absolutely. I mean, the first way that you can approach this statement is that In a data set, you have paired examples of input and labels. So the labels help define the goal. You create some cost function based upon the labels. But how do you get these labels? You know, how do you decide, you know, what the so-called grand truth is? This is, you know, this can be extremely problematic, and it kind of depends on how the data is collected, if it's hand-labeled, who hand-labels it, those kinds of things.
Right. So, all right. So let's take a deeper dive into thinking about the data sets. I think ultimately I want to sort of come around to using voices and voice as an example, because I think it's probably been the most work done there, and it's a way to sort of focus the conversation. But apart from the labels, how and where, here's the prompt. So how and where does the data potentially bias the behavior of the network?
Well, it's kind of amazing. We see bias creep up in almost every single domain of machine learning and the associated applications. So I'll just throw out like some really famous examples that are you know, I think in 2018, New York Times ran an article that was about some research that happened at MIT that just showed that, you know, facial recognition didn't work the same for people of different skin tones. And that has been shown time and time again. And a lot of it comes down to what kind of data are you going to collect, or how are you going to label that data? I don't know if you've heard of, I think it's Tay, Microsoft, in 2016, cut the unfortunate nomenclature of the racist bot. So Tay was a bot that was designed to interact in language, in written language, with people. And very quickly, we found out that all the data that Tay learned from included awful, awful racist language, and they had to pull the algorithm. So that's happened many, many times, because the internet is full of training data, but also very bad training data.
Right.
Where else do we see bias pop up? A very famous example is gender bias. Is a very famous algorithm called Word2Vec. And this is a model that lets you basically embed words in some space and do mathematics on that space. So you can kind of determine, you know, the distance between two different words, and you can do addition and subtraction. So the canonical example that I can think of is in Word2Vec, you can do some arithmetic where you basically say, what is the answer of woman plus king minus man? So woman plus king minus man leads to queen. And, you know, the algorithm would do just fine on that. But then when you ask it something like, what is woman plus doctor minus man? It would come up with nurse. And clearly the answer is doctor, you know, it's not nurse. But this is how the algorithm had just kind of subtly learned to capture biases in the data that it was trained from. If we want to talk about audio, we have a lot of issues. Just backing up a little bit, in machine learning, we like discrete categories and buckets. It's much easier to train an algorithm when we can discretely label things as yes, no, binary. This crops up a lot in gender, in speech synthesis, and speech to text, and these kinds of algorithms. We often want to label things as male or female, and there's no way for us to do that in this discrete way without having the biases that are inherent in the data set crop up and then leak into the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So you could also argue that, you know, oftentimes we're trying to solve a task in a discrete fashion when that doesn't really align to the real world, and we end up in hot water there. I care very much about musical audio, so bias happens in all kinds of places in musical audio. The first I could think of is that a lot of algorithms that ingest musical audio have a strong bias towards Western music. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Western music is just a small portion of like, you know, of, and I don't even know how to describe Western music, but there's an over-reliance on, let's say, like the diatonic scale and stuff like that. And this really creeps in and can be really damaging in the way that these models get consumed. For instance, if you have music recommendation services that are very biased towards certain genres or certain styles of music, then you kind of turn off the ability for people to consume, you know, music from underrepresented areas or just areas that aren't represented properly in the data set.
So if I remember correctly, we had an experience at iZotope where we were developing some vocal processing data sets. And I seem to remember that there were two things that the network learned that we didn't intend for the network to learn. One of them is that all vocals were in tune because we fed it tuned vocals. So going back to your sort of Western music idea, the inference was made, even though that wasn't an intended consequence. The other was a sort of, in some ways, a minor but a technical issue, which is the sample rate. The data was constrained to a limited bandwidth, and therefore that was the assumption was made by the network that was the intended result. So how do you guard against that kind of thing?
One is just slowing down and really taking a look at the data set. I think that I fall into this trap, a lot of other people too. The fun part is to build the models and train them. And I personally think the least fun part is working with the data. Hmm. The amount of time we spend collecting, cleaning, pruning, listening to data, it's awful. It's not fun, but it's necessary. And then, like in any good system, you want to build in redundancy. So, and redundancy on a human level. So it really helps if you have people spot check your data. If you ensure that the people who are labeling the data are representing a diversity of backgrounds. These things are really difficult. Data collection in of itself is time consuming. It can be expensive in other ways if you're paying people to label your data. So we end up taking all kinds of shortcuts because we just need a lot of data. We need to produce an algorithm that can perform a task, and we want to do it as quickly as possible, but slowing down helps.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide what you want? The question I'm trying to ask is something like, you know, how do you describe the thing that you want the machine to learn?
Yeah, this is a really good question, actually. I think that I find that there's a chicken and egg problem all the time. You have really interesting tasks for which there is no data, and you have really boring tasks for which there is a lot of data. Mm. And it often just happens that you do the boring tasks that have a lot of data because data collection is so expensive and time consuming. So we end up in this kind of, you know, I would say like a bit of a loop where in the research community, someone goes out and does the hard work of creating a data set, which probably has all kinds of implicit biases that are captured in that data set. A bunch of people do some interesting work on that data set. And then from that point on, it's really hard to let go of it. So we keep doing incremental work on that data set. We keep developing our algorithms. Our algorithms are built around the task that the data set was made for. And so then we end up kind of in this echo chamber of the biases of the data set, keep going back and forth, you know, like we were talking about gender a minute ago and stuff like that. And it's hard to break free of that in the academic publishing world. You want to evaluate your models, not just train, but also evaluate models on unknown entities, on data sets that people are familiar with. So we kind of get locked into these particular data sets. Once in a while, someone comes along and does the hard work of creating a new data set, and that kind of opens us up to doing more things. Did I answer the question?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And one of the things it's stimulating for me, and is, I assume, one of the challenges in getting data, apart from just the sheer physicality of collecting it, is also the IP considerations, you know, that creates some friction. It's like, well, yeah, who owns my voice and the inferences that are made from, you know, from it.
This is such a thorny area that I'm definitely not qualified to speak on.
Yeah, you know? And I won't ask you to, but but you know, but it is interesting to surface it as a point of friction and one of the things that makes this complicated and difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just using data to make inferences on inputs that are similar to the data. We're now getting into this, you know, world where we're making really interesting models that generate new sounds, new text, new media. And, you know, you use data to train these models. So when you ingest, you know, a bunch of speech by, I don't know, Jane, and then you have a model that synthesizes speech that isn't Jane, you know, what's the connection there? Right. I don't know. It's really complicated. I don't, like I said, I'm definitely not qualified to speak on any of that stuff.
Yeah, that's really,
but it's certainly interesting.
Yeah. So I guess before we end, if you want to spend a moment or so talking about the thing that you're currently involved with, which is this notion of reverb matching. That seems like a really interesting project, to try to figure out some way to, here, I'll let you describe it.
Well, thanks. I mean, this is an easier topic to talk about because, of course there's biases in everything, but I think that we get away from all the traps of some of the other kinds of models we're talking about. In general, I'm really interested in models that can take some target sound and then turn some knobs for you on some audio DSP and help you achieve that sound with a new input source. And so for the case of reverb match, we basically just want to point to some reverberated audio and then have an algorithm really quickly tell us, okay, here's how you turn the knobs to make some other audio sound like it was recorded in the same acoustical context. I'd say it's a, you know, we can kind of avoid some of the bias stuff that we were talking about earlier in this territory because the data that we generate really comes out of some audio DSP. Of course, there's going to be bias everywhere, so I'm not going to say strongly that there's never bias, but I'd say this task falls more into the category of interesting tasks for which there's not a lot of data. So we've spent a lot of time on this project and projects that are similar to it, trying to generate an enormous amount of data through particular audio DSP plugins and algorithms and stuff like that.
But in some way, you can generate your own data.
We can and we do, which means that we have more control. So
interesting. Great. Well, Andy, thank you so much. This has been really, really interesting. I'm going to think harder about this. I'm going to think harder about who owns my voice.
Yeah, sounds good.
Anyway, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Headroom. Join me next week when I speak with Mark Ethier, CEO and founder of iZotope. I'll get Mark's perspective on topics such as innovation, equity and equality in the tech industry, and the future of the development of audio products. Headroom is a podcast produced by iZotope Incorporated, music by Smigonaut. Thanks to the team. See you soon.